gaggle of geese. More fun than a room full of wombats. Able to reach huge audiences with a single broadcast. Yes, it's the Outdoor Journal Radio Show. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Well, hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us once again, Outdoor Journal Radio, the podcast. I'm Angela Biola. He is Peter Bowman.
Hi.
Bova, Nick, and Dean, the regular crew with us. Awful nice of you gentlemen to join us again today.
Give me a hell yeah.
Damn right.
And the audience, too. Thank you. I didn't mean the gentleman meaning the audience. It was the gentleman in this room.
Come on now.
Because our audience is not just male. We have a lot of female
viewers
and listeners, too.
Nice.
And why wouldn't we?
Well, I hope we would.
Why wouldn't we?
You know? Nice to mix it up a little bit.
Absolutely.
I'd rather have more female viewers than male. How's that?
Because you're the stud, man.
I'd rather. I know what the reality is. Yes. I'd rather. I mean, I'd rather be Brad Pitt than Brad's armpit, and I know that's where I'm sitting. So,
What a wonderful show for, if not you, certainly us. And I'll tell you why. A little later on, we'll be joined by a couple of people that are doing what we've always dreamed of doing. They're spending most of their time propelling an exotic-looking underwater camera that's capturing all those beautiful, beautiful animals down below the surface that we very seldom get a chance to see other than when we haul them up into the boat. Yvonne Driebert and Zach Melnick will join us a little bit later on. They are cinematographers, first and foremost, but they've gotten into this underwater stuff that is absolutely fascinating.
It's unbelievable.
You found them. You brought them to the light. So.
And the good part about it is you don't often see freshwater footage. You see a lot of saltwater footage. This is a lot of freshwater footage, and it is good.
Mm. There are companies called Inspired Planet, and they do documentaries and all kinds of interesting things that you'll find out in just a little bit. But first, as usual, we have things to do. We need to remind you folks.
Look what's coming up,
everybody. The Sportsman Show is upon us.
Wow.
It is here.
Give me a hell yeah.
Everything that you see here.
How many years has that thing been going?
Well, it had a little interruption during the pandemic, but other than that.
And did the shift from the CNE to the downtown, and then remember that one?
Yeah, there was a bit of a kerfuffle there with the mayor at the time.
Yeah.
Didn't want
that,
guns.
What was it? Conference center?
It went to the Toronto
Convention Center.
Convention Center.
Yeah, that was kind of a cluster, wasn't it?
Oh, my. That was, I think, 2 years.
Double-o-mize.
Right?
Yeah.
And then it moved to where it is today, the International Center, where you fine folks will be with us, I'm sure, watching us from our booth that we'll be doing this very podcast live,
I guess. This set right here is going to come along with us.
Along with all of the other podcasters on the network. They'll all be there. Antonio, Steve, Frank. I mean, all the boys will be there. I know I missed some names there. Don't worry about it. I'll make it up.
Jerry might even make an appearance.
Jerry will be there.
Yeah.
Jerry. Where was that?
Hello, Jerry.
No, it wasn't Jerry.
It was Gary Howard Stern. That was Richard Simmons. Gary.
Oh, God, that's a great show. Oh, my goodness. Anyways, I'm wearing a beautiful piece from our Fishing Canada collection.
Piece collection. Listen to you. You're so full of shit.
It's a bunch of bullshit.
Thank you, Dean.
It's not a bunch of bullshit. It's one of the many pieces from the Fishing Canada collection.
This is not bullshit, but the oozing of the orifice. That can be sometimes
oozing of the orifice.
Yes, whatever's oozing
That's
out of your
disgusting.
Orifice is a bunch of bullshit sometimes. So
all right. Anyways, it's there. You know what I'm talking about. Never mind this goon. You know what I'm talking about. This and all other goodies are like you see on the screen.
Yeah.
All available at the store on fishingcanada.com.
Come on now.
I want to remind folks too that you will be able to buy a lot of this stuff at the Toronto Sportsman Show. The Fishing Canada booth, at Outdoor Journal Radio podcast booth.
Come on now.
And you won't pay any of that nasty shipping. And who doesn't like to save on shipping. It's one of those things. But shipping especially, like it's taxes and shipping. Those are two things that like you pay it out, but you say, I don't want to pay that.
You're right. Absolutely.
Come down to Toronto Sports with Joe. You won't be paying any of that
stuff. Right. You're going to be there anyways, right?
Exactly.
But I've always wanted a nice little Fishing Canada shirt, hat, whatever. There it is. Done.
A listener feedback. Very interesting one today because it's, I don't know, coincidental or not. I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of it, whether it was pre-planned, not pre-planned. But anyways, we're going to talk about smelt here in a minute. But what makes this interesting is that Peter and I were at an event earlier this week,
Don't leave Dean out.
Come on now.
Who the hell cares about Dean, for God's sakes? Well, you and I were slugging the booth in and out there, Nicole, and Dean, he was in there yucking it up with the young ladies.
Dean put this listener feedback smelt talk into this, so we wouldn't even be talking about this if it wasn't for Dean.
True.
Come on now.
All right.
You're welcome, Dean.
Thank you. Yeah, it's true.
All right. But anyways, we were at this event earlier this week, and those people came to listen to the invasive species presentation that was going on there. But this guy came up to us halfway through the whole deal, and he says, I didn't come here to talk about Asian carp or anything. I just wanted to come in here and ask you guys, where the hell are the smelt? My smelt are all gone. So
he came for that reason. We asked him, what about the Asian carp? I'm not here for that.
I want to find out what smelt. Where's my smelt?
It was awesome.
So then we come in and we see that this podcast on listener feedback is about smelt. So somebody is trying to do something here.
Something smelt.
I think it's Dean Taylor. He's trying to set us up. He probably said that's probably a relative of his. That came and talked. No, not this. That came and talked to us.
Get a relative, a smelty relative.
No, well, he set it up. He had the relative come in and asked us smelt. So we were in the frame of mind, and then we come here on the podcast, and he's got us set up.
Yeah, it's all part of the plan.
It's all part of the plan.
Anyways, Robert Myatt.
Myatt, yeah,
would be correct, I believe. Yes, via email, he sends in the listener feedback, and he says, go ahead, actually read that, Peter.
Want to say that all the talk about frying up smelt, so we must have been talking about it in the
previous
past,
show.
Right?
Previous, right. I think, last week's show, yeah.
Brought me back to my childhood in rural Nova Scotia. So yes. Obviously they have a good smelt population out there, too, or did. I would catch hundreds with my grandfather in the brooks that poured into the ocean inlets, then spend the day sitting on an upside-down bucket in the shed, cleaning them with a pair of scissors. Miss those days. And that's true, man. We used to clean them with – that was the best way of cleaning. The most efficient way of cleaning was with scissors.
It was fun catching them and lifting that dip net and filling up the bushel baskets of smelt.
And when you lift that dip net, you were kind of hoping that they're going to get a bigger haul this time. And they'd be sometimes you'd have 30 in there and sometimes you'd have 3,000 in there. It was so crazy.
But then the stark reality set in after that, after you took those seven bushels of smelt, put them in the back of the pickup truck. And now you realized, I'm going to have to spend the next couple of days cleaning up.
I think Gordy, my dad, Gordy, it was his favorite part because he cracked the beers. Well, he probably cracked beers open on the shoreline, too.
But then
he gets back home. Now he can have a controlled environment where he can drink his beer. He takes his scissors, cuts a couple of smells up, and then he gets the kids to clean up the rest of them.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Help me out here.
But they were delicious, I got to tell you.
They were good. They were very unique.
Fond memories, yes. But also we were as kids just thrilled to death to eat them because they were delicious. I don't know of any kid that ever said I don't like smelt.
Yeah,
they were
another
great.
Email. George Van Cedar, I believe I'm saying that right. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, my dad and I would get a lot of smelt on the beach in Port Glasgow. Glasgow.
Is that Scotland?
I wonder. Is that Dean? Anybody?
It was an Ontario email.
Okay.
He
might have still been as a kid. He might have been over in Scotland because that's what I thought at first. That was Glasgow. Yeah. But I don't know. You know what? It's not spelt the right way.
Oh.
It's Glasgow over there. So where did they all go? Huh. It's a good question.
Well, and finally, you say that. I mean, we've known forever, but it was a part of the discussions we had last week with the folks from MNRF. That were there, we had a chance to talk a little bit about the smelt. Mm-hmm. I think most people know, but just for those of you who don't. So Lake Ontario and most of the Great Lakes, all of the tributaries, every fresh. It seemed like everywhere where there was fresh water, at one point we were inundated with smelt. And most people thought that they were an invasive species that were introduced into Burnley because they're a saltwater fish. And you can get smelt in the oceans are still there, and you can buy smelt at fish markets, the saltwater smelt. They were originally a saltwater fish that made its way up the St. Lawrence into the Great Lakes and et cetera. But the real boost for smelt came in the mid-60s to early 70s when smelt was being used to feed all of the wonderful salmon that were being stocked into the Great Lakes, in Lake Ontario in particular, cohos and chinooks. We imported, brought in whatever term you want to use, a smelt as the food source for this voracious feeder. And lo and behold, the smelt, all of a sudden, they outgrew the predator. And for a number of years, we had a real problem in this part of the world during spawning season, the spring, with smelt, because they would die when they were done. They were all over the shorelines, and municipalities had to bring in workers and spend a ton of money because they stank so bad. They had to clean them up.
Seagulls couldn't get enough of them.
No, seagulls couldn't finally turn their nose up. I ain't eating that crap.
Pick the eyes out of them only. That is it. Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's the plight of the smelt. They stopped stalking them. The predators finally ate enough of them that it affected their reproduction cycle. Mm-hmm. Bob's your uncle. And today we have virtually no smelt.
Except for our last email. We got three emails to this. Ron LaRue via email. He says, my wife's son, Ben, every year gets a good amount of smelts for us. Every year. So it's current, obviously. I could send you a good fry-worthy amount if you'd like. So somebody's getting them somewhere.
You know where I heard that there is a population of smelt, believe it or not, is Lake Simcoe.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's
I caught one last weekend.
So there you go. Yeah. So you're right then.
Maybe because it's not direct. It's connected to Lake Ontario, but not directly, right? And there's no salmon in there. Salmon would have been in the trout population. So Lake Trout would be the big smelt eater out there. Smallmouth would do it. Walleye would do it.
I mean, any of them would.
Pike. There's not a lot of muskie in there, but no. Maybe these salmon are so devastating on the population.
Well, it was the numbers. It was the numbers, right?
I'm just saying that they're hanging on there. Maybe there's the correlation with salmon, like, you know, Chinook salmon. 5 years, they grow to 35, 40 pounds, 50 pounds. They're eating everything and anything, and they're probably eating more than a small... 1 month, they'd eat more than a smallmouth they'd eat in his life. You know what I mean?
We're talking hundreds of thousands of salmon that were being stocked.
Right.
It was just sheer numbers. Yeah. I mean, they just overwhelmed, even though there was...
I'm talking about in Simcoe, though, now. Because there's no salmon in Simcoe. Maybe that's
why they survived.
Maybe they're surviving because of a couple of species that aren't there.
How they got there, though, is still a bit of a mystery.
Well, there is the chain that goes down to Lake Ontario, right?
Yeah, but they'd have connected, to go through the locks.
Go through the lock system.
Hey,
we talked about those invasive carp coming down from Lake Erie down to the St. Lawrence River. True. You know, either they come down Niagara Falls and survive that, or they come through the canal system, the Welland Canal system. Yeah. And then we also talked about invasive carp could get up to the Nipigon River from Lake Erie, let's say. Yeah. So, craziness.
Anyways, bottom line is, it was a special time in our lives growing up in that era where you could go, you know, with your dad, your grandpa. It almost became a ritual.
Mm-hmm. It was a ritual.
Yeah,
it was. Sure. Spring ritual.
Every spring, you get the rubber boots on. And,
oh, my God, yeah.
The kerosene lanterns, the tires that they would burn. We would burn.
Yeah. Oh, think about that one. Oh, my God. Endless fire going on there.
So we take...
And it was all groups of guys, too. It was always like along the shoreline. You just see it for sometimes 500 yards. You'd see these just groups of guys and fires and groups of guys and fires.
It was the best. I have so many fond memories of those days.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah.
But anyways, very social.
Thank you for allowing us to go down memory lane for all of you who wrote in. Why did all of a sudden we get emails on smelt? Was it just the episode?
Yeah, I think the one that just aired, they must have heard. So,
all right. Okay.
I think it's bringing back a lot of memories to a lot of people, but it sounds like things. Right?
Yeah, so. For sure. If you want to weigh in on this subject or any other subject, please do. We're always asking for folks to give us reviews. subscriptions, thumbs up, whatever you can do to interact with this program and any of our socials, please do. It helps us to stay in the business. How's
Come
that?
On now.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Well a little said. Bit of, well said.
A little bit of a plug there for yeah, us.
We That's, need it.
Do we it ever?
Helps. It helps.
FishingCanada.com. You'll also see that we have the podcast network highlights there on a regular basis. And sitting there right now is a right up on a new episode, episode 36 from Eating Wild, Antonio and the boys, Luigi. And Daniel and Chris now. They have
Hook
added
set.
A fourth.
Hook set, smash,
top
dog, and siege,
and the other
CJ.
One,
CJ, siege.
Yeah, I know, but you know, he's got
drop
one
shot, Dean.
Showtime.
Showtime. What did I say? I had a wrong one in there, didn't I?
Yeah, you did, but that's fine. That's okay. See, if it was me, if I like I'd have made you'd have highlighted that and embarrassed me in front of our wonderful audience.
I just
audience.
Highlighted
but,
my mistake.
But see, the way I didn't even go
it's
by
because
it.
You didn't even know I made a mistake.
Oh, you? Oh, I knew. Dumbass. Believe me, I know every one of them. Trust me, I could write a book on them.
I'd read that book.
No, I know you would because you'd forgot that it was you that authored the mistakes.
I'd have to learn how to read, but I could do it.
True. That's so, true. I can help you in that area.
Okay, thank you.
A lot of pictures.
Making seafood sexy. That's the name of that episode 36. I like the sound of that already.
Wow.
Hello.
Oh, my.
That sounds very good. The return of canned seafood, the importance of wild caught, why canned food gets a bad rap, and canned seafood recipes. All there on Eating Wild. On the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network. And Come by the now. Way, they'll all those boys, all those names we just threw out, they'll all be at the Toronto Sportsman Show.
That's right.
With us.
That's right.
In the news, Mr. Bowman, what do we got? This is right up
this
your alley.
Is this is a morning. Really cool story that...
By the way, before you even go into it, I probably... Oh, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
I'd like to hear your preamble to the story.
No, you go ahead.
What, are you going to give me shit for something again?
No, just my views and opinions. That's all. Okay. I like to share them with the audience every once in a while.
There's a bass fishing professional out mm-hmm. there that is starting to use augmented reality glasses, as you see in the picture here, Brian, to connect to his fish finder.
I often think you wear augmented reality glasses.
That's here, right. The ones that I wear make you look good. These ones.
Timing is everything on that.
Woo! Yeah, this guy, Ed Logren, Loughran, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name, 53-year-old Bassmaster Elite Series Pro, has figured out how to link his glasses to his fish finders. And the real reason for this is what the tendency now, all of a sudden, with this forward-viewing sonar, especially, everybody's got, they're locked on their fish finders. Their eyes are locked on their fish finder. That means you're fishing like this all day long. Mm-hmm. All day long. Well, it's strainful on the neck. So now most companies are starting to build rising mounts for these things that you can put up higher, which we did in our boat last year. But Ed says, I don't need it. I can keep that right down there. I can look anywhere. I can just look around and I can see the fish finder screen on his glasses. So I don't know how, I think it's wired still. I believe it's a wired pair of glasses he picked up on Amazon. Is that correct?
Yeah, he made some sort of contraption with Amazon. Yeah.
And that's what he's been doing to look at his live scope. I don't know what the clarity of the picture would be. I can't see it being that great. There's got to be sunlight coming in and everything. I mean, we're always trying to cover our eyes like that when we're looking for...
It's connected, by the way, with an HDMI, which would seem pretty clunky.
That's a big cable.
That's a big cable.
Wow. HDMI cable is as big as that pan right there I'm holding up.
How the hell's he move around?
He probably just stays there. Maybe he sits Bill Dance style in that seat and locks onto it or something like that. But it just shows you that technology is just going to keep advancing and advancing and advancing. And there's going to be, now that this is coming out, there's going to be wireless glasses that wrap around almost like your Apple goggles or something like that. And then you're going to be like, these. He'll never see anything else, but well, maybe he will. One eye can see the whole rest of the world and one eye
Imagine
watches
the tan you'd get from that.
Oh,
the Apple ones, like
the raccoon eyes.
Oh my god,
that'd be crazy. But that's what's going on out there right now. That's how important the you know, this forward viewing sonar stuff is getting. Speaking of which, did you look at the weights of that Bassmaster yesterday? That there's a Bassmaster right now as we're recording this.
I had to work yesterday. Yesterday was a work day night. For me.
Yesterday's fishing. It didn't come out till after work.
It was a work
they
day
didn't
for
post
me.
It till after work.
All right.
So obviously you don't care.
No, I do. And what were the weights, Peter?
The weights were so incredible. I bet you I have it right here. The top weight, well, five fish, 39 pounds, 1 ounce. Top 10, 10th place was 31 pounds, 15 ounces in 10th, 32 pounds. To make the top 20, Cooper was top 20. He had 28.4 for four fish, 7-pound average.
My God.
It's on Lake Fork in Texas. It's insane.
Like, holy. That lake has been since I was a kid.
32nd place, 25 pounds plus.
That lake, I remember as a kid growing up in the bass world. Lake Fork was always that place you want to get
because
yourself.
The main reason is it's got great management. It has got fantastic management. They have that Share Lunker program on there, and it is working so well.
Kind of like
them,
this company.
Well, great management.
Fantastic management.
Yeah.
That's a bunch of bullshit.
No, yeah, thank you, Dean. Not a lot of sharing, like no Share Lunker going on.
I'm going to take that button away from you. I'm going to put it right here in front of me.
Anyways, Ed, good on you for trying. I don't know if I like it or not, but I think it'd be kind of cool.
I was reading something recently about another innovative new toy in our world, and that is virtual reality goggles and games where you use the virtual reality thing, but as it pertains to fishing. And there's a whole virtual reality.
Like a fishing game, you mean?
Game. Or,
oh, cool.
Yeah. So people are spending a lot of time.
One.
And I was thinking as I was reading it and watching the video on it, it's kind of a shame, though, really, because as we've always said, fishing is the excuse, the theater for getting outdoors and immersing yourself in the outdoors away from home, away from urban centers. You go fishing to get out there.
You don't like being home?
Huh?
You don't like being at home? You want to get away from your home? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my.
I'll get back down that one. But now we're creating ways of eliminating that, and we'll let you get your fishing fix right there in your bedroom.
I'll tell you, like through the winter, Canadian winter, if you're not a real ice angler, that's not bad.
By the way.
Sit on the old couch there and catch a couple of largies. Woo-hoo.
By the way.
Yeah.
In sort of a connection to this story, we had a NASCAR driver win a race last year, never having actually driven a real car. Can you imagine? So this kid, who is a world-renowned champion of racing on the simulators, and he's been like five-time national and international champion, world champion of racing NASCAR on simulators, he got in a car and won a race.
He literally got in the car.
He said the most difficult part for him was getting used to the real pedals and shifters.
Right. Come on, really?
I'm not kidding you. Read it, check it out. Wow. I can't remember the kid's name.
Pretty much awesome.
He won a NASCAR event against all those pros, having never been in a real car on a real track.
Did he get a practice run? He must have practice runs and stuff like that.
I would imagine they probably embellished the story a little by saying it was his first time racing, but I would imagine there was some kind of practice time. You don't go out there 200 miles per hour on a speedway
with
40 other cars, So they must have made sure that he could do the job, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine NASCAR as an association probably signed off on it, said, hey, you can't argue with results.
Yeah.
The kid was probably putting in winning laps when he was practicing.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you're saying, okay.
And he won.
That's crazy. That's like astronaut training. It's the same thing as the astronauts.
Yeah. When you think about it, right? Yeah. They never get a chance to actually go up there.
Yeah.
But anyways, I thought that was kind of cool. And it goes with this, you know, fishing with virtual reality goggles and stuff. So
wow. You can win the Bassmaster Classic without ever pre-fishing. And then all of a sudden you go down there, you pre-fish that tournament and you could win. That's what you're saying. Yeah. It's possible.
Ah, it's fascinating. I was born way too late. I should have been born. I was born too early. I want to be born today. Can you imagine today?
I wish you were born today. I really
why is that?
Just because that's what you want. No. I want everything for you.
I always have to question because with you, like when I shake your hand, I have to count my fingers because you never know.
I can what just steal, I'm your, steal your fingers? I'll steal your ring. I won't steal your fingers.
Anyways.
Is that gold? Is that a gold ring you're going
to have? Where were we?
We are moving on. Ed's story.
All right.
Was there anything else? We didn't need anything
on
that.
No, we're on to fan question. We got to move. We got to move here. We're eating up valuable time. I got a group
this
of people
week's
coming
fan
on
question
with underwater
is brought,
cameras.
Is brought to us by Kyle Benning from Iowa via email.
I like that. That we're getting US
fishingcanada.com. I think it's great. Yeah. Yeah. Now, maybe Dean's just feeding us a bunch of more American stuff because we like it. I'm not sure.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
Oh, thank you.
See, you had that button there, didn't you? You need one, don't you?
We're gonna There's get one a bunch of bullshit.
Oh, perfect. I just do that.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
All right.
You can go ahead and read this one, Mr. Biola.
Kyle Benning from Iowa.
I just said that.
Submitted. I'm just clarifying it.
Oh.
That's all. Kyle Benning from Iowa, as you can see clearly on the screen behind me.
Iowa.
And by the way, he submitted his question by sending this to info@fishincanada.com or on Facebook, Instagram, and all those other ones.
Come on places. Now.
He says, many anglers believe that we're educating fish. Now, this is an interesting question.
It's good. It's a really good one.
Many anglers believe that we're educating fish and they are adapting to new presentations and lures. And it's happening at a rate faster than ever before. And he goes on to say, I heard one fishing expert, whom I respect very much. He didn't give us who that was. I wish he knew that. Says that new lure trends used to be effective for a decade or so. Now fish are adapting inside of 2 years. Now, I wonder where this research came from, though.
It sounds like a Gord Pizer thing, maybe.
You think?
An expert. He respects him, so I don't know.
Huh. Do you subscribe to this theory? He wants to know. And if that's the case, how come some classic lures like MEPS, inline spinner, wrapless shad wrap, and original? Well, I don't know. It's funny he mentions wrapless shad wrap in the same sentence as MEPS inline spinner. But, anyways, and the original floating wrap still proved to be effective. So some stay around and work. Others come and go because fish get adapted to them is what he's saying. What do we think of that theory, Mr. Bowman?
Well, I think it's just a natural thing. I think these fish, I think they are they get onto something. If it's a bait, if it's a whatever. Once it's artificial and it's not in their real world, it's not a minnow, it's not a crayfish, not something real, and they get stung by it or see their buddy getting stung by it, I'm assuming that they get used to it, right? I would think. I don't know if it's going at a faster pace or not versus maybe there's more anglers out there right now. Maybe there's more anglers using different baits now. Or like that. I don't know the pace of it. But I think they definitely, you know, get used to presentations for sure.
Apparently, according to the scientific community, they actually pass it on through their genes to their offsprings.
There you go.
So
I don't know how that works, but that's cool.
I don't either.
But that is
nature
cool.
is a wonderful thing. Well, think about it. It's the same as any wild animal. If there's something that comes into its environment that causes it pain and or you know, decline in population, nature has to be able to trigger something within the animal so that the next gen and the gen after that don't right.
Yeah.
So it's passed on through genes and fish are very much like that. And we know for a fact that there are areas where you could go in with a white spinner bait for, you know, a decade and just clobber smallmouth bass. And then all of a sudden you couldn't buy a smallmouth bass with a white spinner bait. So, so we have evidence that would substantiate that.
And it makes sense, right? It does make sense.
But the interesting part is, though, is what he said here, and he missed probably the most important bait old school bait that he doesn't have on the list, and that is the daredevil.
I knew you were going to say the daredevil.
The daredevil.
Yeah.
It's never stopped.
Right.
It's never stopped.
He's right. The maps too. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
That's why I scoffed at the shad wrap, because it's a relatively new bait.
But the floating wrap, for sure.
Floating for sure. That's another one. But then again, that one is pretty understandable because it hasn't changed and it's still an effective way to catch fish.
Still looks like a minnow.
Still looks like a minnow. The other ones don't.
Yeah.
Right. And then there's still, who would say that a well-placed MEP spinner in most circumstances won't catch a fish?
Right. I think we'd have to look beyond that. We'd have to say the lake that gets fished with a MEP spinner the most, those fish will adapt to that as well. You know what I mean? They're going to get used to it. If it's stinging them and all that stuff, I think they're just getting used to whatever people are throwing the most in there, right? Repetitiveness is what's scaring these fish off or turning them off or whatever. Right. This is my opinion. Yeah. So if you're throwing a MEPs every year, and all of a sudden, hey, I'm not catching fish, I think that's going to happen. I think they're going to progress away from that as much as they liked it before.
The other aspect about that, I think the guys who are still throwing like a daredevil or a MEPs, if they're keeping the fish, then they're not learning. You've ended that process.
That's a good point.
So if you're taking it out,
wow,
then it's not like it's telling its buddies.
Dean, you're a genius. Yeah. Push the button.
I don't have a genius button.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah. It's not Dean. It's genius. It's
Gene. We'll call him Gene. But that's a great notion, though, because you're right. All of these old baits that we're talking about were introduced and were prevalent in an era where catch and release was not. And so there was no opportunity for those fish to pass on through their genes onto their offsprings, not to bite a MEPS lure, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right?
But today, because catch and release is so popular and because a lot of people, if not the vast majority of anglers, are putting fish back, that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So all of these newer lures are suffering to that, right? The fish are being turned off by them.
But it does make sense.
Great idea. Give yourself another hell yeah, Dean.
Give me a hell yeah.
Thank you. See how nice I am to you?
That is very nice.
Yeah. All right. Anyways, it's an interesting question.
You're obviously agreeing that the fish are adapting, right? Or they're feeling it or something's going on, they're changing? Or do you?
100%.
Yeah, okay.
100%.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it.
Your thoughts on the fish finder signals and stuff
same thing.
Same thing.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And going back to what we just talked about, that's why the daredevil is a great example. You know, that's probably one of the most famous lures of all time. Mm-hmm. There are fishing situations where if you're not throwing a daredevil, you will not catch fish.
Right.
Right? There's certain jurisdictions, lakes, whatever you want, species, where if you are not throwing a daredevil and sometimes very specific color daredevil, either red and white or five of diamonds, the yellow with red, you're not going to get anything for some bizarre reason.
Yeah, you go up north. If we went to Northwestern, Great Slave Lake, Great Bear Lake, let's just say use those two lakes as an example. If we did not bring big red and whites and big five of diamonds, we would be out of our minds because they work still to this day.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Now we know why Dean just filled it in for us.
Don't kill them big ones.
It's going to be a game changer.
Fishing will not be the same in Canada.
Hi, everybody. It's Toronto Sportsman Show time. And the entire Fishing Canada Outdoor Journal podcast crew is going to be there.
That's right. We'll be in-house hosting live podcasts, interacting with listeners, and fielding questions from you, our audience, all weekend long.
You can get 15% off your admission price by purchasing through the link on fishingcanada.com.
Spend a weekend with us at Canada's premier event for outdoor enthusiasts, the Toronto Sportsman Show.
Now, I'm saying... The humble goldfish, everyone's favorite aquatic pet. It's small, easy to care for. What's there not to love?
Even the cat may be mesmerized by the color and movements of your aquarium friends. Goldfish are great at home, but don't let them loose.
Releasing goldfish or other domestic aquatic pets or plants into natural environments is harmful to both your pet and the planet.
Goldfish disrupt ecosystems by outcompeting native species for food and resources in degraded habitats. They contribute to algae blooms, they kill aquatic wildlife, and pass viruses and diseases contracted in aquariums to wild fish.
They could even live up to 40 years and grow as big as a football. Anglers, this is where you come in. If you find a goldfish at your local fishing spot, report it to the invading species hotline or go online to eddmaps.com.
Remember to never dump your live bait into the water and risk spreading other aquatic invaders. Keep our lakes free from invaders and don't let them loose.
How did a small town sheet metal mechanic come to build one of Canada's most iconic fishing lodges? I'm your host, Steve Nidzwicki, and you'll find out about that and a whole lot more on the Outdoor Journal Radio Network's newest podcast, Diaries of a Lodge Owner. But this podcast will be more than that. Every week on Diaries of a Lodge Owner, I'm going to introduce you to a ton of great people, share their stories of our trials, tribulations, and inspirations. Learn and have plenty of laughs along the way.
Meanwhile, we're sitting there bobbing along trying to figure out how to catch a bass. And we both decided one day we were going to be on television doing a fishing show.
My hands get sore a little bit when I'm reeling in all those bass in the summertime, but that's might be for more fishing than it was punching.
You so confidently you said, "Hey, Pat, have you ever eaten a drum?"
Find Diaries of a Lodge Owner now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
All right, now I am so excited about today's guest. Now I don't want to make it sound like I'm not excited every episode, but this one's very near and dear to my heart and yours too.
Absolutely,
because we're in the production business, we're in the film business, we're in the taking picture business of mm-hmm. fish and aquatic mm-hmm. life below the surface. Uh-huh. And uh-huh. that's what these two people do. Folks, thank you for joining us this morning. They're with Inspired Planet, Yvonne Driebert and Zach Melnick. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, my God. It's our pleasure. Trust fantastic. Me on this. We'll have a lot more fun with this than you will. First of all, just bringing folks up to speed, you are cinematographers, obviously, and you do documentaries. You're from Ontario, Canada, which is cool. How long have you been doing this?
We're actually a husband and wife team, and we've been making documentaries together. You know, I generally like him, so we work together. And we've been making documentaries for a little over 20 years now. We were high school sweethearts back in the day. Wow. So we don't
like each other, and we still work together. You know what I mean?
And it's been 40 years.
Yeah, try that, okay?
You've done some award-winning stuff that we've had an opportunity to have a peek at. I just want to mention a couple of them. The Land Between, you did that in 2012. And that's a wonderful story about the Canadian Shield and the whole outdoors thing. A Desert Between Us and Them in 2013, which is one of my favorite subjects, by the way. Colonial wars and, you know, 1800 wars and all that. And this is about the 1812 war, right?
Yeah, it was the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812. Wow. So
we got to burn a few barns and a few houses and get the American flag of Canada one more time. Even though we're in don't Michigan right now, so we very much like them today.
Yeah, I got you. Good one.
First of all,
the Bruce. Don't forget the Bruce too. That one they did. Bruce has been a couple. Bruce.
Yeah, that. What was that about? We weren't clear on that one. What's the Bruce about?
So the Bruce was a three-part series about the history of the Bruce Peninsula region in Ontario. So we actually started making movies looking at the history of different communities across Ontario, working with TV Ontario to bring the story of rural history in Ontario to life. And more recently, we have shifted towards more of a environmental wildlife focus. And so we did a series, a 17-part series with TV Ontario called Striking Balance. And so we looked at Canada's biosphere reserves. We got to go from coast to coast to coast, looking at how people were trying to create a more sustainable future. And a lot of the times that involved fish. And it was doing that Cross Canada series about the UNESCO biosphere reserves, where we first ran into this issue of the impact of quagga mussels on the ecosystem of the Great Lakes. And that really led us down this road to investing in this sort of new technology, these robots that allow us to film down there. But I think we'll get into that in a minute. Yeah,
yeah. Are you guys from the Bruce area? Is that where you live?
Yeah, we live on the Bruce Peninsula. And yeah, that's really how we started getting into this story. We noticed, that the water was incredibly clear around mm-hmm. where we lived. And while that's really beautiful, that also means there's not a lot living in there. So right. that kind of began journey into digging into sure. what's going on here, despite it being lovely.
I have some memories. I worked at the Bruce Hydro plant up there, and my drives used to be from Oshawa or Port Hope, Ontario, to the Bruce. And unfortunately, I did it through the wintertime. And you guys have some of the worst storms and winter storms that I have ever encountered in my life. Like a normal 3-hour drive would take 7 hours, 8 hours to get there. Like, it was unreal. So it was brutal. Yeah. Oh God.
You were going right through the worst part. Oh, we yeah. live a little off the peninsula. We tend to miss a lot of that. So it's a little bit better.
God, it was nasty. So
normally people would get involved in underwater photography and or video and or filmmaking and or any of the above. Certainly from our perspective anyways, they would get involved because they have a connection with that living organism, fish in general. And the relationship generally is through sport fishing. Are you guys connected to sport fishing at all? Do you fish at all? Be honest with us.
Well, you kind of ding, ding, ding there, my friend, because that's how I learned personally the beauty of nature. You know,
good for you.
Waking up at 5 a.m. and going out on Georgian Bay with my dad and grandfather, you know, that's how I learned how wonderful nature was and how we should all work together to try to maintain and preserve that. And then we've taken a bunch of different roads since then, but now we kind of come all the way around circle again, now taking robots down to the very deepest part of Georgian Bay. Wow. And showing people how things have really changed down there because of an invasive species and how that's impacted those fish that I used to love
the only way that answer could have been any better would have been if you had somewhere along the line there you threw in, and yeah, and I cut my teeth watching the Fishing Canada show when I was in diapers. And that's what got me hooked. And that's why I'm here today.
Yeah.
You can't see it, but underneath his sweater, he actually has a Lana's Gar shirt on, which is like, I'm like, you can guess wear that for this. These folks would love it.
Anyway, that's awesome.
Full party member.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Awesome.
I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you that I was as equally interested in this interview. Equally, I wanted to talk to you guys and see what's going on. We were fascinated with what you do, obviously, but that little character sitting between you absolutely blew my mind. And I'll tell you why. In 1991, myself and my bank manager, John Butler.
Johnny. You know, okay. Oh, yeah.
We decided to go to a show. I can't even remember where it was. Some kind of photography show or something in the city. And we just wanted to go and walk around for a few hours. And we're walking around, and there's this booth there with one of those. I'm going back to 1991. One of those. We had never seen anything like it before. It was a little bit larger, bright yellow. And I ended up buying it. And tried to incorporate it into the Fishing Canada show so that we could get all of those wonderful viz. The problem with that unit back then, first of all, it was all analog. The camera was rather primitive that was in there. We had no capabilities of focus or zoom or any color, correction at all. And the biggest problem was that the umbilical cord was almost an inch
and round. It was bright yellow, too.
And it was bright yellow, too.
So not like scaring any fish away. Oh, my God.
Remember, it was a disaster. And it was hard because this umbilical cord was so thick, it wasn't pliable. It would actually have enough stiffness to it. It would kind of direct
influence the
machine, right? So we kept it for a couple of years, and then we ended up giving it away to The folks in Florida that we worked with at Tenorock.
Oh, wow. Cool. Yeah. That's who got that.
Yeah,
okay.
That's who got that.
He was, and he was always adamant. Okay, oh. And is not the size of that. It's bigger than that. And the case that came with, I'm sure your case is a nice compact foam case, but the case that came with the size of a coffin. This thing, and he, okay, we got to put that on the plane, the bush plane into Northwest Territories. And he, I mean, he had to bring it every time. It was unbelievable.
And nobody wanted to use it. None of our guys wanted to use it because it was so much work.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a lot of work. So we're a little familiar with that type of, in our case, primitive technology, but the one that you've got sitting between you, from what we've seen so far, it is unbelievable.
The footage is unreal.
Unbelievable.
That's for sure.
Well, they are still tethered, unfortunately. We haven't solved the problem.
Right.
Then to see water, but our tether is actually like, it's 2.7 millimeters, so it's pretty small.
Yeah, it's like
a
string.
Fiber optic tether, so it allows us to send 4K video from the unit right to our control station, which looks kind of like a fancy laptop, and you kind of drive it like a video game. But we can see 4K in real time and change any of the settings we would have on the camera. Like if we were holding it in our hand, we can change them underwater while it's going.
Which is huge.
But So it's made by a company in New Zealand. It's called the Boxfish Luna. It's the first one in Canada like it. And we decided, so I'll tell you the story about how we decided that this would change how we could experience the underwater world. So it was the fall of 2021. So not too long ago, Yvonne and I, actually got a little consumer unit. So there are smaller consumer sort of units that are meant for sort of inspecting your boat or something like that, right? And so we got one of these small units, and we took it out somewhere around the Bruce during lake trout spawning time. We worked very closely with the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources, and we got a good idea of where we should go, and then so we went. And after finding them, which didn't take all that long, the way they reacted to this little robot was so incredible. Like they were coming up and they were looking at us and they were rubbing at the robot, and we were like, wow, this is going to totally change how we can show people what's going on down there and give people a whole different appreciation than we were able to before. And so that's when we looked around and said, okay, so how can we, you know, what's the latest in this technology, you know? And the latest was a company, the only one company in the world, a company in New Zealand, Boxfish Robotics, who had basically, the founder of this company used to be a diver, and he was in an accident. And so they wanted to still experience the underwater world. And so basically this unit is like a fancy underwater dive enclosure that you see, you know, the folks on Natural Geographic use or whatever, with a robot on the other end of it. And the other thing that makes it pretty cool, other than we can go down to, you know, 3,000 some odd feet, you know, 500 meters in depth, is that we can swim like a fish. And so we're moving in the direction of a fish, and you have to do that. So we've learned that you have to try to move, so we can move in any direction if we want, but you don't want to do that. You want to move forward. You want to move slowly. You want to move and just sort of match their movements and their reactions. And then you can get inside a fish, inside a school of fish, like a school of whitefish or lake trout or cisco or walleye or really whatever. And with enough time, they will just begin to do their fishy things again. And that's been really amazing and exciting to be able to do that. So we've spent about 135 days so far under the water using this unit in all the Great Lakes. And we're quite excited about what we've been able to get and what we're going to be launching later this year on TV Ontario.
Wow. You know what freaks me out is what they just said there, how that camera at that size, we're looking at it right now, those people that are listening right now, how big dimensions is that camera? For the people that don't have YouTube or not watching YouTube?
It's about 50 pounds. It's about a meter and a half.
It's
the same size as ours.
It's big.
It's the same size as the one we used to have.
Right? But what is my point is that these fish, after 2 minutes, are getting so used to this gigantic camera swimming through their school, but yet we can throw the wrong bait and it can scare them. We can hit the boat like that and it can spook them like there's, it's unreal. You know what I mean? The differences, I guess, by being down in their environment, it's a whole different world.
part of it is that, you know, this thing has a battery life of 12 hours. So often what happens is we'll find one fish, and at first they might be like, but over time they're like, okay, you're cool. And then slowly, you know, often we'll follow them back to their buddies. And then we spend like a few hours with a school of fish.
Yeah.
So part of it is, and then slowly over time, they just get closer and closer and realize we're not going to try to eat them.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's true. It depends on the species, right?
Yeah. Because I'm thinking about, and I'm also thinking about if a muskie rolls into a school of smallmouth, they instinctively know, get the hell out of here. You know what I mean? There's something wrong
the
here.
Shape,
but with that,
shape.
Yeah, the shape, it's just size. But it's interesting.
But they also said something that
looks
I
like a big carp to them.
Is that they have to spend a little bit of time acclimatizing those fish to them, right? And with the movement. And that's the key. Is the right movement. If something doesn't look real and natural, then they would spook as well. This is a game changer for you guys, right? Like it totally, you did a 180, I'm sure, when you were introduced to this type of technology, 180 in your thinking of how to capture those wonderful images as a documentary. This has changed everything, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. It's not only changed everything in how we approach our documentary work, it's kind of made us like amateur scientists as well. And so for this show we're making right now about the Great Lakes.
Called All Too Clear.
All Too Clear. Thank you.
We've made connections with the fisheries folks and fishers throughout the Great Lakes. And we're constantly sending them clips. And they're constantly dissecting what we're sending them. And they're saying things like, wow, I had no idea that they did that. You know, we've never seen anything like this before. And so now about half our work is actually working with the fishery scientist folks to try to increase our understanding of fish behavior down there to see if there are ways that we can help these critters in the future. In fact, right now we're about to go on a mission into the middle of Lake Michigan to try to film a little fish known as the bloater or the chub or the deep water chub or if they're a relative of the freshwater herring that live way out there in the middle, way out like 40 miles in the middle of Lake Michigan. And so we're going to try to use our unit to go down really deep and get these critters on camera, possibly for the first time ever. Wow. And if we're really lucky, we'll be able to learn something about how they spawn because it's the right at the end of their spawning time now. So this is totally, not only are we able to, has this changed how we do our film work, but we've sort of become scientists ourselves now and help to, and that's felt really good too, be able to make that contribution to science and not only help to story.
I don't mean to get into your business or anything, but like, are you folks renting yourselves out, you and the machinery? You're renting yourself out to the scientific community?
If the price is right.
I love it.
Yeah. And so basically we have diversified what we do as a company after we figured out that this is possible. So we actually worked with a company on Manitoulin Island, Henley Boats. And so we built sort of a drone boat specially for this technology. And we do have, we work quite often with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission on different projects, and that's who we're working with now. And so about half our work now is to support the science and half is to communicate that science and show people what's happening down there.
I think you and I need to turn left to make another career out of this whole thing.
Oh, really?
I think we'd have fun.
Okay. We're going to take some work from these guys, though.
I want to go work for them. Are you kidding?
For them.
I don't
want to invest
in that.
For them.
Now we're hiring. Come on over.
did we hear correctly? You've done some work with Dr. Cook, Stephen Cook?
Yeah, actually, I just saw him at a conference last week, and I said, hey, we're going to be on the Fish in Canada show. I saw you were on it. Did you tell them about us? But yes, Steve Cook, we've interviewed Steve, and we've talked to Steve a lot. He's really helped develop, you know, some of our ideas.
We've actually had a few different projects we've tried to get off the ground with Steve. And what he's helped us do is understand. He's put the context of the freshwater fish in our backyard into a global context, which has really helped us understand, A, how special what we have here is in the context of declining freshwater species around the world. And he's helped us to understand some of the more the scientific nuances of things happening in our own backyard, too. So he's really that important voice for freshwater fish around the world and to try to get people to kind of give a crap about.
Fish, I like the way you put that.
I mean, part of what we're able to do with this is show people the freshwater world. You know, everyone sees film of like whales and coral reefs and sharks. Exactly. Like, oh my God, that's amazing. But part of what our goal is with this robot and our show, All Too Clear, is to show people the freshwater world in that, like, put a spotlight on that freshwater world in the same way that the marine world gets a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Clear Great Lakes are a great opportunity for us to do that.
Yeah, yeah. The reason that you said about us discovering them, I'll tell you how I discovered these guys, and it was on Instagram, and I saw your cluster of smallmouth and on your All Too Clear there, and you posted that. And I remember about 6 months ago, whenever I saw it at first, it stuck in my head forever. And I think I took a screenshot or something. I lost the image and I had to search for it. And I said, I got to see that again, because if you're a bass angler, you have to go to their Instagram and see this. And they're All Too Clear, this cluster of smallmouth that are sitting. Are they under the ice or are they?
It is under the. So one of the things we can do with this is cut a hole in the ice and send the robot through, you know, just like you would when you're ice fishing.
Right.
But it's wintertime, and that's in Green Bay, actually.
Okay, cool. Because I saw it, and I said to Dean, you got to see this. And I finally found it again. And then we both said, this could be a podcast. This has got to be a podcast. We got to get these guys. And then we went into your site, and then we saw all the footage, like that lake trout footage of that whole flat there. Where is that, Georgian Bay, or where is that on
that one is Georgian Bay? Yeah.
Like, if people want to see something freaky in the freshwater fish world, take a look at this footage they have of these lake trout that are just laying. Is it spawning? Are they in a spawning time, or what are they doing there? Because it's weird.
Correct. Yeah. They are spawning. And when fish are spawning, we found they're very amenable to being filmed because they got other things on their minds. And the knowledge that we gain from that understanding of that spawning can help them with their recovery too, right? So there's two different reasons why we like to hang out with spawning fish.
The freakiest part of that lake trout film to me, I was watching it all yesterday, not the number of fish is freaky, but there was one fish on the left side of the screen that came from the top and darted right down, flash, flash, flash down, and popped another fish. It literally ran into another lake trout on the bottom, coming down about 30, 40 feet. It was unreal. So people have to look at that just to see what it is. How many fish do you think were in that school? God, it was...
because they come in and out of the shot, what's happening is probably there's a.
So I'm just trying to figure out which shot you're talking about. So are you talking about where they're raining down from the surface?
No, the one where they're all laying on the bottom, and you guys are just panning along, and they're just laying on the bottom. There's hundreds, if not thousands, it looks like. Is that, we saw it yesterday, right, Dean?
Yeah, it was on Vimeo.
It's on Vimeo, yeah. Was it you guys?
Did we send you some links?
Yeah.
Get on Vimeo. Oh, okay. I was going to say, I'm not sure we put that one on Instagram yet.
No, it's on your Vimeo, and it was just absolutely mind-boggling.
They look just like us when people at shows, trade shows, say, remember that episode that you in that big fit, and we look at each other, boy, what's he talking about? That's what they're doing right now. I can tell.
They're saying, who released that? Exactly. We didn't release that out there. What's going on here?
I did some undercover work.
How does the unit deal with the current?
Pretty well. So we've operated in rivers before. If they're clear rivers, it works better. We're able to sort of hang on the edge of current too. So we've been filming in some tea-stained rivers, trying to film whitefish who are returning to the rivers of Green Bay and sturgeon in the rivers of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And so we've got some pretty cool shots there, and we hang right on the edge of the really fast current, and it's quite exciting to do, although you do worry that the thing is going to get, you know, thrown at full speed down the river. But any regular currents that like a diver could handle, say, it'll be fine. It's not unlimited, but it can do pretty good.
Aside from the umbilical cord, is there another tethered line to it? In other words, that's it? No. Just that little thin...
No. Yeah. Yeah, because it's fiber optic, we can send tons of information back and forth through that. When we're operating, Zach is piloting the unit like at that video game kind of console, and then my job is to manage that tether. As you said, that's one of the most annoying parts of the robot is that someone needs to be constantly letting out and bringing in that tether. But when we're operating, it is kind of like, you know, stand like angling, you know, we're going down, we're looking for fish. It feels a lot like fishing, but with the camera. So that's kind of a fun component.
So if somebody had a national television fishing show that had been on the air for almost four decades on a major network in this country, and they wanted to have you folks come in on one of the shoots and actually deploy the unit and watch what was happening from, how would they go about setting something like that?
Wait, you forgot. They GPS waypoint all the schools of fish.
They have the ability to put you right to where.
Okay. So now you sound like my dad, right? So he's like, "Where are the fish?" And I'm like, "We're sworn not to tell you ethically, man." But no, we would be delighted to come along with you. Or you could come along with us on our drone boat too. Or we could go out together, and we can go fishing with cameras, and I'll tell you, it's going to be just as exciting as fishing with a rod.
We do a little bit of camera work now, not with that old. I told you our unit is long gone, but we now use little cameras action that you could drop down and action cameras. It's so cool. So when you were telling us about what you do, Zach, and you're running the ship and we can relate to that, because when we get that camera down and we start playing with it, we forget about the rest of the world up here, right? And we're just so focused on getting that imagery down below. It's a new world.
You guys talked about the stained water. What's the capabilities? What is the picture like in that tea colored water? We see the Great Lakes and it's beautiful. Can you still get a good image in that tea colored stuff?
In tea colored, yes, but if it's really turbid, like there's lots of particulate in the water, that's still a limitation. We haven't been able to fix
that.
You can't filter that out, right?
Exactly.
When it's really, we don't want to run into rocks, basically.
Of course. Right. For the camera heads out there listening, can you tell them what the camera is that you use in that unit?
Sure. So, the main camera that we use in the unit is a Sony A7S3. And so this camera has very good low light capabilities. And so using this camera combined with the very clear waters in Lake Huron, say, we can see at almost 300 feet of depth without additional lights.
Wow.
And
how cool is that? That's awesome. That's
That could be total blackness on your GoPro or something like that. Combining that low light camera technology with this ROV underwater drone technology lets us be in those deep lands and see that deep world that has been basically invisible up till now.
Is there a focal length on the lens? Is there any lens in particular that you use on that one?
So we can swap out the lenses just in the same way you would swap out the lens if you had in your hand.
Is there one better the best all rounder or anything like that?
So the battery is built in.
The lens on the camera.
16-35 is our 16-35 2.8 is kind of the go-to lens, which is kind of the go-to lens for a lot of underwater diver photographers as well. But we also have used the 24mm 1.4 lens too, if we want to really see in the dark.
We have a 50mm macro as well.
And so macro lens.
What can you control from above in terms of the camera?
All the settings. All the settings you can imagine. Wow. And we even have it set up so that if somebody wants to pull focus, be with us and pull focus, they can do that too. So
that's crazy.
Two camera operators, somebody running the ROV, somebody doing adjusting the camera settings, and then somebody on deck controlling the tether system.
Wow.
The other thing that we do when we're operating is that we also use a trolling motor. So when I'm out on deck, if we found a fish or a school of fish and we want to go with it, I'll move our boat. We have 300 meters of tether, so that gets us pretty far. But if we're with a school of fish who's on the move, like we can move with them while the unit is underwater. Now,
that's cool another too.
One thing of the, that we figured. One of the problems we used to have is not knowing where the camera is. In terms of, first of all, in the actual positioning, we don't know where it is, but we also don't know where it's facing, what direction it's facing. Do you have a full array of directional screens and stuff that are telling you where it is?
So there's, on top of the unit is a little pinger. It's called a USVL. And so we send another little pinger over the side of the boat, and that's connected to another thing that goes to satellites. So we have a tablet that shows where the unit is on a map, where our boat is. And then we can mark exactly, like we have a little trail of where the unit's been.
That's awesome.
We can get a GPS coordinate of where the unit is. Actually, this past summer, we discovered a shipwreck in Lake Huron from 1895. And with this, we were able to get an exact GPS coordinate of where the wreck was so that we can go back and do like archaeology work and stuff like that. But it really allows us to know. Before we got this USBL, we had those moments where we send it over the side of the boat. And we're like, I hope you come back.
Exactly. And where is it facing?
But now we know where it is.
That's great.
Wow.
Is that shipwreck from the footage we saw, I don't know if it's Vimeo or wherever, but the one covered in zebra mussels? Is that the one you're talking about?
You got it.
Oh, my God. That's incredible.
So it's called the Africa, and it went down in 1895 with 11 sailors on board, unfortunately. But the kind of crazy thing is that the captain of the Africa was named Hans Larsen, and we happen to live in a place called Larsen Cove, which was named after this tragedy. They didn't know where the ship went.
Really?
And so now we found this ship, and actually his grandkids have gotten in touch with us since we found the ship, and we're going to take them out this spring to go check it out.
Oh, that's awesome. God. What a great story.
Good for you. We interrupt this program to bring you the much-anticipated bonus code for the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. This week's code is PITCHURE. That's PITCHURE, P-I-C-T-U-R-E. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards all our current giveaways. For those who haven't entered yet, what the heck are you waiting for? Head on over to fishingcanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode. Click contests and sign up for all the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. And now, back to the show. You mentioned the shipwreck and the zebra mussels. How detailed are you, this documentary about the mussel invasion in the Great Lakes, how detailed are you going to get? Is this a series that's going to be sort of ongoing?
Well, it's going to be a three-part series on TVO. And so basically 3 hours exploring this massive change that's happened in the Great Lakes, its impact on fish and people, but also it's this opportunity to show people what's down there in a way we haven't been able to before. But this really started because of the collapse of Lake Whitefish for all intents and purposes in the main basin of Lake Huron and in Georgian Bay and in Northern Lake Huron and in the main basin of Lake Michigan. They were already basically gone from Lake Ontario and Lake Erie. But really the collapse around the Saugeen Bruce Peninsula where we live and its impact on the indigenous communities there and really all throughout the Great Lakes is what first led us on this mission to try to figure out what the heck's going on out there. And we really spent a couple of years trying to research this. And a lot of arrows point to the fact that the bottom of the lakes are now basically an invasive species bed. Right. So you don't see it as much around the shore. There used to be zebra mussels, right, everywhere around the shore. Now what we have are literally quadrillions, which is 1,000 trillion of these little guys making up the lake bottom of the beds. And this is true in Lake Ontario.
It's true in Lake Huron. It's true in Lake Michigan. And it's true in Lake Erie, too. But it's having different effects in different spots, depending on how much nutrients are in those lakes. But in Lakes Huron and Lakes Michigan, it's been quite devastating, especially for those commercial fishers, because this is their number one fish that they fish for. And just to be clear, you know, the science does not point to this having anything to do with those commercial fishers, because they are well regulated in the Great Lakes.
Right.
What's happening, or as we understand, now we're not scientists, is that so there are quadrillions of these mussels. If I took you out to any spot in Lake Huron or Lake Michigan or Georgian Bay, took you out to about 150 feet or so of water and dropped down the camera, I'd say there's about a 90% chance that we'd be looking at mussels. And this is any random spot. So not the shore, out in the deeps, in the depths. And so each one of those little monsters is pulling down, is filtering between 1 to 7 liters of water a day. So all the water in Lake Michigan can get filtered through a mussel in about a week or a week and a half.
Oh my God.
That's crazy.
So how is that not going to change?
No kidding.
Okay. So our story is really trying to bring this to light using this new technology to show people what's happening out there and really trying to speak for the fish, right? Because they can't speak for themselves.
We've been led to believe, and when I say we, I mean the angling community, if you will, that in fact, the zebra mussel had sort of become part of the food chain over time. You know, about a decade into it, we started hearing stories that, hey, you know what? It's become an important part of the whole food chain thing. Have you got evidence of any of that happening?
Yeah. So what's happened actually? So we all know about the zebra mussel, but they actually have a cousin called the quagga mussel.
Right.
And so they came in just a little bit after the zebra mussel. And basically what's happened is that the quagga mussel has outcompeted the zebra. And if you look at them, they are kind of hard to tell the difference. But that quagga mussel is the one that can go deeper, doesn't need to stick to anything. It can just live on the lake bottom. And what's happened is that none of our fish have jaws strong enough to break the adult shells. So once those mussels get to adult size, nothing can eat them. When they're little, things can eat them. But when they're full-size adults, nothing really eats them. And that's part of the reason they spread so much.
What about a freshwater drum, a sheephead? Could it not? Because apparently it eats zebra mussels. It gets they have those stones in their throat and they crush. Can they?
Just to clarify a bit, we're primarily talking about the offshore ecosystem. So we're talking about that vast, like, open waters of the lakes that few people ever go to. And so the nearshore fish, a lot of them have adapted to this new world created by the mussels. And it really is a new world down there. So, you know, the round gobies, which evolved with the mussels, have come in and now they're the primary prey species when it used to be other little fishes.
Right.
But the angling community isn't wrong. If we took away all those mussels right now and all those gobies that live with them, it would be catastrophic. And so it's this sort of complicated story. Yeah. But the baseline is, so far as we understand, that you go out there and you look at it with a camera and you'll see. So there's only so much life that can live in a lake.
Right.
Right. There's a limited number of and it's created. It's based on the amount of nutrients in that lake, the amount of food. So right now in the middle of, say, Lake Michigan or Lake Huron, most of that biomass, that stuff, is now stuck in mussels out in the middle of the lake, where before it was up in the water column, moving around, creating little bugs for the fish to eat. But now that's stuck down in the bottom. And fish are adapting to this new world. They're eating it. But the bottom line is there are less fish than there were before, but not necessarily in that nearshore zone where the sports fishers lived.
Right.
Hence, big impact on species like Lake Whitefish and Cisco and alewife that the salmon eat. And that's really the story that's happening way out there in that deep land that no one ever goes, that our show is about.
Right.
How about
really interesting.
We were talking about the front half of the show before you folks came on. Smelt. Are you seeing any smelt out there at all?
In our work, we've seen a couple in the Green Bay area, but not schools of fish. Now, we're not scientists and we're not doing like specific surveys of what fish are where, but no, we have seen what we believe are alewife.
Yeah.
Still, and so we have seen like quite a bit of them. We have seen what we believe are little lake herring schools, and that's a really good sign.
Yeah, no shit. Like,
that's the native crayfish that you know evolved in our lakes and that are do really well in those low nutrient environments.
Yeah.
Smelts, we've only seen like a handful in our times out there.
What's the weirdest fish you've seen in fresh water in the Great Lakes? Is there anything that you see, oh my God, what is that? Or is there anything like that out there?
Well, I think that all our fish babies are special. You know, you don't want to go throwing around weird and not weird. But we have seen a bunch of fish that maybe have, you know, look a little bit different than other fish, say, or have like a little bit of a back issue or okay. something like that. And we did see a burbot. And I think it's actually, I'm not sure if that's on our Instagram or not yet, but he's got a bit of a weird back thing going on. But you know what? We see a bunch of these sort of slightly different looking fish, and they're out there doing fishy things just like all the other fish. Yeah. Right? When we filmed Lake Whitefish spawning, there was another fish with a little bit of a back issue. But you know what? He was right in there with all the rest of them.
Why not?
And that's kind of a cool story. Right?
I mean, sea sturgeon is pretty cool.
I was going to ask about a sturgeon. Yeah.
Actually, the first sturgeon we saw, it was in Green Bay in the winter. And we were like, what is that? It was in the distance and we couldn't figure out. We were like, what is that thing? And it actually came up to us to check us out. And we're like, we're losing our minds, you know. And here's the sturgeon just kind of chill. And, you know, he checked us out and then we hung out a bit. But sturgeon, it's great seeing a dinosaur under the ice.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right?
You guys are living the life, man. I'm telling you.
Any thoughts on the possibility of Asian carp invasion, like a grass carp getting into the Great Lakes and all that? What are your thoughts on all that?
We haven't seen any yet.
No, good.
Hooray.
Good. See, that's a good sign right there. That's a good sign because that's going to be another invasive. That's going to be
no carb comments. It's all muscles all the way down for us.
The impact that the muscles have already had and are having, you know, obviously if carb get in, it's going to be a pretty big deal, but the impact, the muscles are already here and already having this tremendous impact. Probably, you know, the biggest change to happen in the Great Lakes since the glaciers. Right. Yeah. So that's already a pretty big deal. So I think hopefully bring some attention to this story to let folks know what's already happening.
You know what? It's great. These guys will be a great monitor for like the commercial fishermen. We did a thing this week with the invasive species people, and commercial fishermen are a big part of it because they, you know, it's their business. So they'll report these Asian carp. But you people can be doing the same thing if you see that. You know what I mean? Hey, guess what? There you are here now. So yeah, keep your eye out for it, and we'll put you in contact with the people to talk to.
We will. We know what to look for.
Yeah. AsianCarp.ca is the site, by the way.
Yeah.
Like I said, you're living the life. We envy you and that little thing between you. Have you named it, by the way? We always name our equipment.
It does have a name, actually. I don't know.
And the name has a story. So we've called ours the Kai-Eye.
Kai-Eye.
And so what Kai-Eye is a really cool fish. It used to be the fish that lived in the deep waters of all the Great Lakes that the really big lake trout used to eat. But one by one, it disappeared from Lake Ontario and Lake Huron and Lake Michigan. And now it only lives in the deepest parts of Lake Superior. Wow. And it has never been captured on film before. And so we called our robot Kai-Eye, both aspirational. We hope to go out and film a school of these incredible, super deep water fish, and because we can go super deep and see and way down in those deep waters just like that little fish can too.
Nice.
How, now that you turned it sideways and gave us a little more profile, how tempting is it to get an artist or even somebody maybe with a wrap to make it look like a fish, like put scales on it and eyes and stuff like that? Because that would help.
I've thought of it. Yeah.
That would help, you know.
We have thought of it, and there may be some ways of we're going to be experimenting this upcoming year, I think, with some different techniques, leaving empty shells that look like this unit in areas where the where fish are more shy and sort of getting them used
that's
to
an
it.
Idea too.
Cool.
But I think dressing her up like a fish is not a terrible idea either.
I couldn't let you leave. I know I've read all the stuff on your website and other websites about it. No, the pricing of these units is being kept under, you know, hush hush. Can you kind of share, you know, ballpark?
Tell both of your kidneys you can get one.
Both. Yeah, so
good one.
That's
great.
Mid-range bass boat.
Wow, really? Okay. Well, we know that your camera in there is at least $4,000 for something without the lens. That lens is another $2,000.
It's about $1.75.
For the
full thing. You know what? Well worth it.
Not as sparkly as a good bass boat, though, so you have to pay more for
it. It's a little slower, too. I will say that.
Where can folks get more information on what you incredible people are doing and maybe also in terms of your broadcast schedule for... the documentaries?
So the show is going to be coming out to TVO this fall, and you can check out our trailer for the show and find our Instagram and all the rest at alltooclear.ca.
Well, I think it's alltooclearfilm.com or go to alltooclearfilm on Instagram and Facebook or X as well. And look for a three-part series called All Too Clear, Beneath the Surface of the Great Lakes, coming to TV Ontario later this year.
It sounds fantastic. Hats off to you guys. Congratulations. And by the way, Yvonne, I do the same. I always screw everything up, too. So he's got to straighten me out.
It's okay. As long as we have straighteners around here, we're good.
Now we need a straightener for the straightener is the problem. Anyways, you guys are fascinating. We love what you're doing.
The footage is absolutely, for those listening, is absolutely incredible and spectacular. There's going to be some good stuff coming up. So,
and yeah, if we can hook up with you at some point along our travels, that would be out of this world. In fact, we're going to be down in their neck of the woods.
I've already talked to them about that.
Well, excuse me for living. I might as well just
straighten you out a little bit. That's all I'm doing is straighten you out.
Come on down. We'll come fishing with robots. It'll be real fun. I promise.
That'd be cool.
We look forward to it. Thank you very much. Great meeting both of you, and all the best.
Thanks so much.
See you guys.
That's it. I want a new career.
You just want a new camera. I know.
Well, I want a new camera, I'm not going to be able to get the camera, if I tell her I want to start something new.
I guarantee you she will ixnay that so quick. She wants you to retire. How are you going to start something new like that?
Well,
you're going to retire from this and you're going to
something new? I can do stuff.
Well, you could do it like Yvonne and Zach. You could have Monique come out with you.
Oh, the Countess on an expedition.
Yes.
She did one once. You know that.
Well, yeah. She never to be done again. Yeah.
You were there, yeah.
Maui.
Maui.
Beautiful place of Maui. Hey, Monique, you want to come on another shoot? No, piss off. I don't like that anymore. It's too much work.
Anyways, this documentary, folks, you got to check it out. It is from what we've seen so far, I think it's going to alter the way we perceive fish. That one scene with the smallmouth bass on that rock,
freaks me out.
Going to redefine what we believe fish are doing under the ice.
Absolutely.
Right? Smallmouth bass, yeah, especially. So
I'm telling you, when I saw that, like I said, I saw that image for the first time, and it stuck with me for months. Every week, for sure, I would see that image. You know, I thought about smallmouth. I would see that image go in my head, and then I finally found it again, and I've watched it 25 times, the video now, since then, just to see what they're doing down there, and thinking, no way. Is that even possible? I mean, yeah, way it is. It's right there on camera, on film.
Anyways, check these guys out. They're the real deal for sure. And it's great dynamics, husband and wife. That's another yep. nice plus about it. But check them out. Well worth your time and effort. That are it. We got to move along. My goodness.
Where are we going now? We're early in the day.
I have no idea. By the way, Sportsman Show, as we mentioned at the top of the program, we're going to be there. The entire Outdoor Journal Fishing Canada crew and staff are going to be there. So if you've ever wanted to meet, you know, the cameraman, for example, the drone pilot.
Volvo's going to be there?
He's going to be there the whole week.
Wow. Is he going to be there on time?
Now, mornings are going to be a little difficult for him, but that's fine. We'll figure something out. It's not an early start. That's the beauty of it.
Oh, it's not? Okay.
Well, I don't think so.
Well, with you, you're going to say Volvo. No, if it's an early 9 o'clock start, Volvo's got to be out of bed at 6.
Oh, my God.
Because you know you're going to make him get here, and we got to get coffees, and we got to stop here and do that. Oh, he's going to be complaining. He's going to put a grievance in here for sure.
Nick might even make an appearance or two there. Well, it depends. If it doesn't interfere with his private life, you know.
Okay.
He's got a multitude of things he's responsible for.
We got Dino coming for sure. We know Dean's coming.
Dino will be there, and everybody else, Steve, I mean, and all the podcasters on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network will be there.
Yeah.
Give me a hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
It's
going to
be a big love fest.
Yeah.
You don't want to miss it. That's at the Toronto Sportsman Show coming up the 14th.
And we'll be recording live podcasts as well there. Right?
We're going to be doing this show live.
But yeah.
Right? Well, yeah. Live
to
whatever.
The people there. So.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
Even if we don't even film it or record it, we'll just look live.
Yeah,
right?
Just look live. We'll sit around and fake it. Cameras really won't be rolling.
Volvo will be drinking his lattes there and having fun.
Of course. Don't forget, fishingcanada.com, the gateway, the portal to your next fishing and outdoor adventure. While you're there, get involved in the many contests, giveaways, and goodies that we have for you.
Come on now. Mm-hmm.
How about shop.fishingcanada.com, just to end on that one, maybe?
Please.
They want to look good like you do in that shirt, or maybe Thank even you. Like me in my little shirt here. So,
yeah. Get all the paraphernalia. By the way, this will all be available at the Toronto Show too.
Come on, we're selling that too?
I'm telling
Come
you.
On now.
I'm telling you, the whole deal.
Wow. Don't have to pay shipping that way. Right?
See, only you would think of that. I never even thought of that.
I like to save our peeps some money.
All right. On behalf of the entire crew, Volvo over there somewhere waving at you, Nick with his That's a Bullshit t-shirt on.
That's a bunch of bullshit.
That's right. And over here, Dean Taylor, our producer. Peter Bowen, I'm Angelo Biola. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you at the Sportsman Show.